Mediated Conversation on SAFM.
26 minutes now to 9. Well, last week came as a shock, I think a horrible, difficult, awful shock. A shock to see the looting and the violence. Along with that shock came, I think, in some places, a sense of fear. Fear can lead to anger, which means the way in which you feel now is likely to be, well, perhaps very worried, perhaps sad, perhaps losing hope. But one of the things that humans do is that they heal, and they often heal in important and serious ways. Sometimes they even heal to be stronger. It's not an easy process, and I must just say we don't always heal. Things can go wrong in the process, and it can be very difficult. But the process of healing is a very important process, and it is this process that we're going to discuss this morning. First, you'll hear from Father Michael Lapsley, president of the Healing of Memories Global Network, and then you'll hear from the psychologist Nomfundo Mohapi, the CEO of the Center for Mental Wellness and Leadership. She's a clinical psychologist. We start then with Father Michael Lapsley. Father Lapsley, good morning, and thank you for your time.
Hi, good morning, Stephen. Good morning to the listeners. Great to be with you.
Well, thank you for your time. We've all seen what happened last week, and I suppose one of the conversations around healing may involve a conversation around what actually happened, and in this case, what started the looting and the violence.
Yes, and also what triggered it and what kind of deep wounds played themselves out in our body politic.
How do we start a process of healing after something like last week? Is there a place where we can begin, a place we can, I mean, maybe we have to agree to begin in a place?
I think we need to begin with introspection. We need to say, how did we get to this place? You know, my colleague Fatima Swartz pointed out that often as South Africans, when we see these terrible things, we say, this is not us. But of course, actually it is. You know, if a Martian was to arrive today and look at the Zondo Commission, look what happened to this last week, and people said, this is not us, they'd laugh their heads off. Because, of course, this is part of who us is. But I think it, you know, reminds me a little bit of what happened in 94, just before the elections. Bombs were going off all over the place, and everybody was saying there's going to be civil war. And as South Africans, we took a step back and said, no, that's not who we want to be, actually. And we went and voted. And so again, we as we often do as South Africans, we walked to the cliff edge, we looked over the edge, and we said, no, this is not us. So we've seen the worst of us as a country and the best of us as a country. And the best of us gives hope, but I think we will keep going to this cliff edge if we don't truly face what has happened. And I think there's a relationship, Stephen, between the economic and the social and the psychological, emotional and spiritual. Let me give you an example. During the lockdown, we had this 350 Rand grant, which for millions and millions of people took them away from starvation. Then we took the grant away. And so we pushed more people into abject poverty. And so we saw a greater degree of hopelessness. Now, were we to reinstate that grant, even increase it, then I think we would have renewed hope. If we were to see employment increasing instead of decreasing. So I think we've got to actually say, is our political system, is our economic system, let's be sober about it 25 years later. Now, I don't know about you, Stephen, but when I look at where we are as the most unequal society on earth, 25 years into democracy, I feel a sense of guilt and shame. But what do I do with that guilt and shame? Can I transform it into a commitment towards transformative justice? And I think that's the challenge we face as a country, to ask ourselves the deep questions, but also be open to speak of our woundedness as well.
I think one of the problems, there's so many different things that come out of it, and to listen to you speak, Father, I sort of think sometimes I think we almost don't know how to express how we feel, and we don't know how to express how we feel to the people who kind of need to hear it. You know, we're missing the vocabulary, we're missing, I suppose, in some ways, the language, both to speak and to be heard.
Yes, and I love what you're saying, Stephen, about we need a new language. We need the language of our heart not just of our head. And it starts in every family when we can speak to our loved ones about how we feel. Because if we're able to externalize even horrible emotions in a safe place, we can't begin to let go of them. But if we just keep them inside of ourselves, they continue to damage us and destroy us and destroy those with whom we have intimate relations, which is part of one of the elements in gender-based violence.
Over 200 people died in the violence last week. The number that I have is 212. And their relatives, their friends will be grieving for them. And each one will have, you know, their own grief. And the nature of this is that sometimes people will be grieving for more than one person. But this is also a society grieving for people we've lost through COVID. I've lost count of the number of times I've spoken on air about the death of a prominent person who's passed away and not been able to give them what I consider appropriate attention because, you know, another person dies or three die in one day. And these are just, you know, people who happen to be in the sort of socioeconomic political space in which they get mentioned on the radio. There are so many more. And I worry, I think for some people, the feeling of grief or the anger as a result of it all, it's on top of itself. There's more and more and more just being piled higher and higher and higher. And as a society, we're almost being, I suppose, squashed underneath it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, in a way, we're seeing this multiple woundedness and the old wounds and then the new wounds on top of it. And it's playing its toll. So we need to find ways in which we can care for each other, recognize that it's okay not to be okay, but also to find different forms of self-care and, if you like, a new rhythm for our day when we're able to quietly look at what's happening inside of ourselves, deal with our own demons so that we become free to work to change society. But as you say, grief upon grief upon grief, and we're all affected by it. But we need to give ourselves permission to speak about it.
We've had a few calls of people who phone and say, I'm so angry right now. We took a call from a person called Sipo in Soweto. He was angry at a particular thing. We've had other people. I've had one or two people saying they're scared. I've had very few sort of saying anything else, but anger is the one that comes through. How do we make sure that anger doesn't overpower us?
Well, I think we've always got to say what is behind anger. Anger is a presenting feeling, but behind it is often vulnerability, inadequacy, powerlessness. So if we can begin to speak about that, then we can begin to find the way of saying, what do we do with it? I mean, you know, apartheid made the people of South Africa unbelievably angry. And so in the end, we were able to channel it into a liberation struggle. So we can either respond in ways that destroy everything, or we can transform it into ways that are life-giving for ourselves and for others. So it's, if you like, we all need to become wounded healers, recognizing our own woundedness, but then from that, to take that anger to the vision of a different kind of South Africa.
It would help if we all agreed on what we want that South Africa to look like. I don't know if we all feel that we're on the same journey.
Well, I think at the most profound level we are, in the sense of saying, you know, we want a decent society for our children and our grandchildren. We want all to be able to flourish. But we have to have those conversations and truly listen to each other. One of the problems we have is that we often have verbalism. We have these beautiful, beautiful slogans, whether it's by the ruling party or by the opposition. But they are often devoid of content, and often the substance is the very opposite. So we need to recover, if you like, also a moral language, and where good is called good and bad is called bad.
I think sometimes people are too scared to judge anymore what's good and bad. I mean, people won't make those judgments, at least in public. They'll sort of say to their partner, well, I think this happened and this is bad. But people are almost too scared to talk, and I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, all of us can sometimes, I suppose, be told that we're too quick to judge, and I think that can be true. But if we lose the right to call something bad, that must be a problem.
Of course it is, and I think it's good to think before we speak, and to keep on introspecting, and also keep on dealing with the dark side of our own selves. But if we are not able to recover a moral compass, then we are lost completely. So we need to actually lift. I mean, for example, who are the moral giants of our society? They're the whistleblowers. These are the we need to actually point out who are the real role models for ourselves and for our children that can inspire us. But we do need to have a moral language in which we can speak and not be afraid in the end, even if it makes unpopular, to say, this is wrong. So we need to say the looting is wrong, whether it's a CEO who also joined the looters or whether it's the industrial scale looters of the rich and the powerful. But we need to say it's wrong, whoever it is. But at the same time, we need to attend to the conditions, the objective economic conditions that create hopelessness in people and lead people to do desperate things.
There are certain processes. So our society has created, and I think correctly, certain organizations who can mediate some of this. So, for example, the Human Rights Commission, if we take the example of Phoenix and KwaZulu-Natal, which I think everyone's very worried about, the Human Rights Commission will go and do an investigation. They can hold hearings. They can have conversations. They can talk to people. How important are those processes? How important is it that we have these organizations that can go and do that, that can try and get a conversation going and at least have some kind of process? I mean, the findings may be important, they may not be, but at least have some kind of process.
Well, I think it's also a way of defusing, because if we ignore it, then it will explode in our face. But in those, if you like, courageous conversations, we can deal with the immediate problems, but we can also face the deeper wounds, the points of racial tension. Insofar as we're able to face them, we can then begin to find an analysis that takes us forward. But even as we speak, we have to be able to recognize that it's also tied up with our hopes and our fears as well, and often old wounds that play themselves out, which is why it's so important to heal the wounds of the past so they don't continue to infect the present.
And leadership, how important is that in this? I mean, there are different leaders who lead different sectors of society. Presumably, leadership can use words, they can help us feel better, they can help us feel worse, but they can help us through the process. I would think that leadership and who we choose to follow perhaps is important.
Yeah, well, I think it speaks to who are role models, but it also speaks to the leaders at every level of society that we deal with our own stuff. Because otherwise the leaders can exploit the unhealed wounds for cheap political ends. So that's why there needs to be a degree of soberness. But I think the leader includes the mother and the father of every family as much as it does to our president. But I don't know if you remember, Stephen, after Winnie Mandela died, there was an extraordinary speech that President Ramaphosa made in which he spoke about our pain. He spoke about our hopes and our fears. And I think our leaders need to also be able to speak to our hearts as well as to our heads. But to do that, they themselves have to be in touch with themselves.
It means that they have to sort of be, they have to want to be part of that process. And that's, I mean, we're asking quite a lot.
And in a sense, to be vulnerable. I mean, some people were very critical. There was one day, one of the famous family conversations when President Ramaphosa seemed to be on the verge of tears. Some people said, what sort of man is he? But many of us said, wow, we have a president who is showing us the fullness of his humanity. And that, in a sense, is an encouragement to us to accept our vulnerability and to be able to see that as part of the totality of who we are.
Father Michael Lapsley, I really appreciate the time. Thank you. President of the Healing of Memories Global Network. In a moment, the clinical psychologist, Nomfundo Mokgapi. How do we start the healing process? 12 minutes now to 9.
Mediated conversation on SAFM.
10 minutes to 9 this Monday morning, continuing your mediated conversation around healing after what happened last week. Let's speak now to Nomfundo Mokgapi, CEO at the Center for Mental Wellness and Leadership and a clinical psychologist. Nomfundo, good morning and thank you for your time this morning.
Good morning, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
Sure. You've spoken about leadership in the past, actually, here on SAFM, and around how leaders make us feel. There are leaders who make us feel good and some who make us, who perhaps maybe want to make us feel bad. How do we tell the difference?
Yeah, so I'm really glad that you and Father Michael brought up this issue of leadership, because I think that's where we needed to focus going forward. And before I answer that, I think he highlighted well how leaders are likely to exploit the wound, but also the fact that when leaders are not healed, they themselves get easily triggered. And you find that they do the opposite of what they intend to do. So they might be going there wanting to calm people, but they mention words that come from their wounds that will actually trigger people towards more violence. And also then they would have the ability to contain how they react to the number of people. We've already talked with Father Michael just how wounded we are as a society. So you actually know that you are next to...
Hello, Nomfundo, can you hear me? All right, Nomfundo, I think we're just going to try and call you back very quickly. Nomfundo Mohapi there, the CEO of the Center for Mental Wellness and Leadership. Just try and get that back on a stronger line. You know how it is when we have lines drop in situations like this. Very complicated, not a lot that we can do about it. I suppose we could speak to the cell phone companies, but you could wish me luck with that. Nomfundo, I think we might have you on a better line now.
Yes, yes.
Yes, good morning. All right, please continue.
Yeah, so then what I was saying was that when you are within people who actually trigger you and make you more agitated in your pain, then you know that you are next to a leader who is either wounded themselves or they haven't learned the capacity to contain how they react to you.
We talk about leaders, and I think to an extent we focus on national leaders and people in government and the president or whoever. But do we also need leaders within our communities who can play this role, who can make us feel better or worse?
No, definitely. When I speak about leadership, I highlight that it's leadership from the family. You know, when you are a mother or a father or a caregiver in a family, you are a leader to education, to community. And it's so interesting, Steve, that what we've seen happen during the violence that we've seen in South Africa is actually how leadership had emerged in the community. And when and leadership is not just about only showing up when there has been a trigger or a violence. It's about building consistent relationships, because when people interact with a caring, supportive, understanding person who still holds them to account, but there is an element of familiarity, there was a relationship before, those leaders are better able to contain people when you have the violence that we have. So this sense that you can bring external leaders who never had relationships with people before, and now they will calm them when they have been violent, is really not going to work. So strengthening leadership at all layers of our society, for me, it is one of the most important tasks going forward as our, in our society.
When we have divisions like we do, is it harder to sort of develop or grow those leaders?
Of course, it is harder, because what we know is that when there's divisions and you've got the history that we have, and we know this now from the study, neurological studies, that those memories that have not been dealt with actually get stored up in our amygdala. And the amygdala's response is when it has been triggered, it's either a flight, or it actually fights. So that's the only response that it needs. But for us to lead, we need our cortex to be activated. This is a part of us that makes us human beings, that makes us make decision-making, communicate, contain, which is what we need from leaders. So what happens is when we are in a divided society, when we have not dealt with our trauma, we constantly get triggered and our amygdala gets activated. And we are really in a crisis, even when we are in a society where mostly our cortex doesn't function, because we are being led by our trauma and our pain. Actually, when we are divided, it is even more important. I say to people, it's no longer just a necessity. I think it is the next struggle that we invest in our healing, because as a society, the more divided we are, the more we need leadership that has got a bigger capacity to contain those divisions.
There's so many different elements to our society, and I think we were a difficult society to heal in the 1990s, and maybe we made a tiny bit of progress, maybe we didn't. Now we have COVID-19 on top of that, which has sort of scarred us again in some way. Do you think it's possible for our society to actually heal? I mean, there are societies that have had very, very bad conflict. I mean, the one example would be Rwanda, you know, in our memory. There are others. But, I mean, I think some people might feel that our society will never heal itself.
Yeah, Steve, I mean, not only has COVID complicated issues, then because we didn't deal with our own traumas, we've now raised a generation that has intergenerational trauma and has to deal with all these memories from us that they have to deal with. And the socioeconomic issues have gotten worse in our country, with COVID having complicated it. So all these things, for me, what they mean is that doing the work of healing has become urgent for us as a society. The good news, Steve, is that, you know, I've worked in an organization where we dealt with issues of deep trauma and people who've been tortured in ways that you can't even imagine. And I've been just amazed at the resilience of the brain and the capacity of the brain to heal. So the good news, Steve, is we might be dealing with centuries of trauma, but it could take few sessions for you to actually be able to sit and be able to heal. So healing is possible if we as a society understand that we need to invest in it.
So it's about knowing it. It's about, you know, people use the phrase doing the work on yourself. It's about knowing it, making the effort, thinking about it, talking about it.
Yes. So the first, I think for me, the first work that we have to do as a society is what I call a work of awakening. We really need to awaken to the trauma. We need to appreciate what happened to us. What are these unseen wounds that we carry? And also understand how they play out. And for us as a collective, how do they play out in terms of socioeconomic issues? How do they impact? I've talked to you in the past how being poor for most people means that they are re-experiencing the trauma. So how does it play out in leadership and how we lead, what we see, what we hear? How does it play out, how we interact with each other? It is no surprise that the racial issues will emerge when we are the most triggered, because that's the core of our wound. How does it play out in terms of how we respond to stress, how we respond to privilege? So the work of awakening and being present and knowing ourselves and knowing our wounds at a collective level, at an institutional level, at an organizational level, family level, is the first stage towards healing. And there are strategies that people can actually learn that help them to be awake to themselves and to know. Because when you know, you can't treat what you don't know, Steph. So when you know yourself and you know your wounds, you can see when it shows up. You can be able to better manage it, and also you can see when it shows up in other people and better manage it. So our biggest crisis is just how asleep we are, how we take for granted the depth of the wounds that we have, which is why we get so surprised by the intensity of the reaction of our society when things like what happened recently in our country has happened.
It's about knowing each other. It's about knowing yourself and knowing each other, understanding where the other comes from and knowing where you come from, I suppose.
Definitely. Knowing yourself, knowing other people, and then when the wound emerges, learning the skills of how to manage that particular trauma, manage your emotional reactions. I always talk to people about what I call the 10% and 90% principle, that when I am wounded as Nomfundo, and you do something, simple thing like the wound of humiliation, which is very key in our country. So if you do or say something that humiliates me, 10% of my reaction to you is likely to be what you said, and I need to hold you accountable. But 90%, the intensity, perhaps the rage and the anger, might be because you have touched my wound. So if I'm awake to myself as Nomfundo, let me say I'm a leader, I'm able to say, okay, I know that I've got a wound around humiliation. It is mine. It's intergenerational. It's my grandmother's, my great-grandmother. So when Steve says something that disrespects me, and he's a white male, he touches my wound, I'm still going to go and hold him to account, but I understand that the rage and the intensity and sometimes even the violence is informed by that wound. So I'm able to pause first before I respond to you. And I'm able to learn strategies to manage my wound so that anger does not consume me, does not consume your relationship. And I come back and I relate to you, not from a space of trauma and wounding, but from a space of being awake to my wound and from the space of healing. That is the work. I'm just using this example to really show like the nuances of what the work entails.
There's so much to it. Nomfundo Mohapi, thank you very much indeed. She is, of course, she is a clinical psychologist and running her own organization at the moment. My thanks also to Father Michael Lapsley, the president of the Healing of Memories Global Network. More coming up through the day here. Kathy Mokgalane, she is next. You're with SAFM, leading the conversation. It's 9 o'clock.